This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today on Sticks In, we are back. After a little hiatus, we are talking through everything that went down in Philadelphia over the weekend and the conclusion of the 2023 PLL season. The Archers are the champions, the Water Dogs the runners-up. We're going to go through everything that happened, not just in the game, but all weekend in Philadelphia, both Saturday and Sunday. I was there for a number of events that are noteworthy. And obviously, we've got a lot about the game, too. So we will take a look both at the Archers, at the Water Dogs a little bit, at the conclusion of the game, where they stand. And of course, we'll get into a couple of those biggest plays of the game that everyone continues to be talking about, still a day later. So we are back. Thank you for joining me. Let's get into it. PLL Championship recap. So we are back. I did not deliver a podcast after the semifinals, and that's on me for being a bad person, I guess. But I am trying to get back into the groove here, as there's still going to be plenty to talk about, even with the PLL season now behind us. But let's not get ahead of ourselves and talk about what's happening after the season. Let's talk about the end of the season. So PLL Championship weekend, for the second year in a row, third time that the PLL has done it, was played in Philadelphia at Subaru Park, just down in Chester, PA. I think it's a really cool venue. I know I was talking with some folks who were there, and I am a big fan of the crowd that comes out for the championship. Even in the weather that we had, it was a really, really good crowd. Nobody was really scared off by the storms or anything like that, or the rain. So you got good, you know, a really excited, and they're really into the game more than they are at just about anywhere else. Some of it, I think, is because obviously there was a strong Philly connection between both clubs and the area, in the sense that there were coaches on, you know, there were players, there was a laundry list of guys who call Philly home or went to school in Philly or, you know, have some sort of strong connection to the area. And then their family and friends show out. You know, you heard it from, you know, Ryan Ambler on the day before in Media Day was saying his brother's got a giant tailgate. He's got 50 tickets of his own. He says he's calling buddies on the team and he's, you know, bugging the league office saying, can I get more tickets? I need more tickets. I'm trying to get more people coming. He's got more people who want to come to the game. Michael Sowers was saying his mom bought 150 seats. So, you know, I think that's awesome, because what that translates into is what you get during the game, which is like in key moments for both sides, really, but it kind of felt like a Water Dogs crowd. Presumably those 150 seats came through for Sowers. But you get like loud defense chants. You get dudes in makeup. You get fans, you know, dressed up and really into it. And it creates this great atmosphere. And the last two PLL times that's happened for me, where I've been to a game and been like, man, you know, the chants, the fans all sitting together and, you know, really, really into the game. There are roars for big moments that you can just feel there's palpable energy. The last two times I really felt that come through was this year at the championship and last year at the championship. It was similar last year. So, you know, the crowds that you get at those Philly championships have been so great. I really like Philly as a destination for the league. I know there's, you know, after the game, it was like, well, this has to be a home market now. And I will tell you, I don't know. I always preface it by saying it's a hot take, but the more people I share it with, the more people who think it's maybe not that hot a take or even think it's an okay idea. But I wouldn't put a home team in Philadelphia, but I would play the championship there every year. I'd make it, the road is to Subaru Park or one day to the Link, whatever it is. But Philly is the town where they play the championship every year. I would sign up for that in a second. I'd be thrilled to go back to Philly. It's a hotbed for lacrosse area. There's so many strong connections between players and coaches in the league, like we said. And the crowds are always great. So I know you want to capitalize on it in the regular season, I'm sure. But there's something about playing the title game specifically in Philly that just fits really well to me. But before that, there was stuff on Saturday too. So the game itself was Sunday. Saturday, I went down. I left here in my home in Connecticut pretty early on Saturday. I wanted to get down and see as much of the events that the PLL had going on as I could. They really had stuff going on all week, but I got down there for it was supposed to be a pickup in the park, which was at Veterans Memorial Park, which is right near the stadium there in Chester. It was the first real, I think, scheduled event of the weekend. And so as a result, the first event of the weekend to be severely altered by the weather. It basically rained or was doing some version of raining for most of the weekend. If it was not raining, it was just kind of like wet and gray. And then, other times you had whatever, the tropical storm blowing through. So, the pickup in the park got sort of altered to be instead just like a stick giveaway at the park. But I still showed up, partially because I had no idea that had changed and I thought they might still be going, and partially because I would have shown up anyway. And there were a few dozen kids out there running around. They came, grabbed sticks, tossed the ball around for a little while. So, I wanted to see what that was about. I think there were supposed to be some pros there, but again, with the weather and the cancellations and stuff, it basically just became, hey, come pick up some sticks. We're going to give some sticks away. Come run around for a bit. And that's what it was. So I was still happy to see that they got some kids to show up, get a stick, throw the ball around on the mini goals a little bit. So that was good, but really I wanted to go see it because I became very interested in, and I don't know if it was just me anecdotally noticing it, but the grassroots marketing kind of stuff for the PLL during the whole week from Monday to Friday leading up to championship weekend felt pretty dialed up to me. I don't know what it was about, they were at the Rocky statue, they're at the museum, they're at Love Park, they're at Reading Terminal, they're going to all, the Philly landmarks, and they're doing giveaways, and come meet this player here, we've got sticks for you, come say hi, and, they do the stuff with the app, come get the, the experience codes, or whatever it is. All week, I felt like I saw that everywhere, and I was thinking about that a lot, because, and I actually, Media Day was part of Saturday too, and I got to ask this question. I wanted to ask, Mike Rabel about it in particular, because it felt like this kind of soft launching or previewing what a home team relationship with a PLL club looks like, right? All week, we've got a relationship with this place that's in our market, with this, historical site, this monument, this or that. We're going to be at this place. Come say hi. Come check us out. We've got a deal here. We've got a giveaway there. And they're kind of just all over the community. They had a truck driving around in parts of Philly that just had a giant, it was like one of those billboards on the back of a truck that had just the PLL, champions are made in Philly kind of banner on it. There's banners, there's billboards on the highway there. There was a lot of stuff that just, it felt like, you were seeing, this is what it looks like when we have a team in a home market. So, pickup at the park definitely felt like part of that. So I wanted it to happen so I could kind of see and try and understand what the response might be. First of all, how many people would show up, how many people would be into it, and see kind of how it was executed and what they did. So, I was really, really, I thought that was cool to see. The home market announcement is going to come in November. We'll find out what teams are going where then. But I do think you kind of got a little bit of a sneak peek of what the PLL wants to try and do in these markets. Of all week long before the game, we've got giveaways, we've got appearances, we've got this, we've got that. And it's tied to noteworthy and specific things within that market. It's not just like, come to the stadium and get a stick. It's like, you're in Philly, come to Reading Terminal and get a stick. Come to the Rocky statue and meet this player. Come understand and make a connection with where you are geographically, which I think is obviously what the move is trying to do. So I thought that was really well done. I wish pickup at the park could have happened. I was not about to get out there and play. Folks, I am old. I have no knees. I cannot run. But it would have been fun to at least, run around out there a little bit, look around a little bit at the players kind of having fun with the youth guys that show up and everything. That's usually a pretty good time. So, yeah, pickup at the park unfortunately didn't go off, but like I said, wasn't total washout. Still a few dozen kids came, got sticks, threw the ball at the mini goals for a little while. So from there, we had media day. There was media availability, which is what you would obviously expect for pro sports championship weekend. It's not like the Super Bowl where it's media week and it's just a zoo, but it's, you know, it's an afternoon, which is all the Super Bowl frankly really needs. But media met with members of the Archers, members of the Water Dogs, and then Mike and Paul Rabel spoke to the media for a while too about, you know, not necessarily just the weekend, but the season as a whole and the, you know, the kind of the outlook going forward. So I will have a quotables coming on sticksandlacrosse.com, so I'll transcribe kind of what we heard. Typically, I just do that for post game, and I'll do that again for this. I'll do the post game presser, so you can, you know, read what everybody had to say in the post game. But I will also do a transcription of what Mike and Paul had to say because I do think it's interesting for fans. That's a lot of the time, you know, when they have questions about the league and stuff, you feel like if you put fans in a room, say you can ask anybody at the PLL who you want, you can bring somebody in here and put them at the mic for questions. Who do you want? I feel like a lot of fans would pick Mike and Paul because they always want to know about what's coming up. They always want to know about what the next big thing is. So I will transcribe all of that, everything that Mike and Paul went through. But Mike did point out that he dropped some stats that he thinks it's a growth year. He was saying it should be a growth year. Ticket sales are up year over year. Their app usage, of course, is through the roof, as you can imagine. It was clear the way Mike was talking about the app usage that was a focus for the league this year. And you can see pretty easily why, right? They've got I feel like a lot of it is the way fans interact with the PLL Nation thing with you can get XP and you can win stuff and you can, you know, rank up as a fan and all that. Mike used the word gamification for it. That's like, yeah, it's like the industry kind of jargon for it. But yeah, like an app where you are connected to the league, but they kind of make a game out of it or a video game kind of feel out of it. So the gamification of the PLL app, I think, you know, obviously drastically boosts its usage, particularly with the demos that the PLL tends to go after. You know, I should say, I mentioned demos the PLL goes after. It's usually the younger audience, but Mike did attribute some of that year-over-year ticket growth to the addition of something like Bar Down, which obviously is not targeting a younger audience. It's targeting, you know, the 21-plus audience. And, you know, I have said before, I've said it during the course of the year, that I think that was a success for them this year because they need to try and attract that market too. You can't just get by with, you know, the kids coming with their dad who buy a Coke and a pretzel and a jersey. If you can get the 22-year-old out there who buys, you know, six Bud Lights and some food and all that and brings a bunch of his buddies with him, that's a pretty good deal too. You can try and make a little more money on the booze sales than you can on, you know, M&Ms and popcorn. So, but, you know, even just from a broadening the viewership of the league point of view, I think the Bar Down was a good move. I think you saw that launched really at the championship series last year. But everywhere they had it this year where I went, I thought it was done well and executed well. You know, it's funny. You go to venues and you think about where Bar Down's going to be. The only place where I thought it was tough was at Homewood, where it's kind of tucked in the corner and you don't really see the field all that well. They had giant screens in there, so obviously you could still see the games, but you didn't have a great vantage of the field. But for the most part, Bar Down was executed really, really well. So, you know, there was some other kind of, you know, there was talk of the Olympics at Media Day a little bit too. Again, I'm focusing here mostly on the interviews with Mike and Paul, but you know, that's a decision that should be coming in the next, call it a month or so. I'm starting to get to the point. I have no information on this. I don't have any insider stuff. I would bet the World Lacrosse folks, if you ask them, would say we're still optimistic. We feel good about it. But when they postponed the meeting and when we kind of haven't heard anything since, I'm starting to feel less than optimistic personally about lacrosse in 2028. That doesn't mean there's no lacrosse ever, you know, but Paul was not negative about it. Paul still felt it's when he was asked about it, and his answer, you know, was still very much about how important Olympic inclusion is, obviously, both for just being recognized globally and it being legitimized by that, And also, of course, you get the resources that come along with being an Olympic sport are tremendous. So, you know, obviously he's hopeful for both of those things. Any lacrosse fan would be hopeful for those reasons. But, you know, I think, you know, there were parts of his answer where he said, hey, if it doesn't happen now, we got to start looking at 2032. And that obviously is the next thing, is how do we push then for the Olympic inclusion in 2032? And that's whether we, you know, lacrosse gets into 2028 or not. You know, you have to start thinking about keeping it in and building it for 2032 and all that. So there was some conversation about a kind of lacrosse inclusion in the Olympics and that decision coming. Again, I'm starting to feel like it's taken this long and the postponement, it's starting to make me feel like maybe it's not happening for LA. I hope it is, because the second they announce it, I would book hotels and plane tickets for myself. I will be there for that Olympics if it happens. But yeah, you know, the longer it takes at this point, the less optimistic I get about it. So, you know, there was some other sort of, you know, there was a lot to go over in those media moments with the players, with the coaches, and then obviously with Mike and Paul. You know, for the most part, player availability was focused on, you know, being ready for this week. And you got a lot of the kind of the typical coach and player answers that you would expect. A lot of talk about how many kind of people were coming for, you know, Michael Sowers was available with, Kieran McArdle and Coach Copeland for Water Dogs. And then, it was Ryan Ambler with, Tom Schreiber and Coach Bates for the Archers. So, you know, it wasn't anything that really was earth shattering in those pregame things. Coach Bates did, of course, in that moment, they hadn't practiced yet, so he wasn't able to kind of say anything about Connor Fields, but did speak obviously very highly of Reed Bowering as a guy that they trust and a guy he knows, you know, is a lefty and was a nice fit into the lineup, and kind of went through that decision a little bit, which I think was good. So, but otherwise, not too much that was, you know, earth shattering at Media Day. From Media Day on Saturday, I went and I was in Philadelphia, so how could I not? I was anxious to do it, went and got myself a cheesesteak, headed over to John's Roast Pork, which was a bit of a hike from where I was, but every bit worth the trip. I sat in the rain and waited in line and got myself a cheesesteak and grinned ear to ear as I was eating it because it was so delicious. And then I went to the smokeout. So Jordy from Barstool is on the Crease Dive. If you're listening to this, you definitely know what the Crease Dive is. If you're listening to this and you don't know, go listen to the Crease Dive. That's Jordy and Dukes from Barstool talking lacrosse. It's a great pod for them. Top 100. I don't think I'm top 100. I don't know. I'm looking up at those guys. But Jordy's other passion besides lacrosse is barbecue. So Jordy and Barstool kind of joined forces with PLL at the Barstool Bar, which is, you know, kind of in the Center City area in Philly, and Jordy cooked a ton of food. Barstool had a whole part of this bar kind of set aside for them. They had a drink deal and everything. So I got to hang out there, hang out with some other media folks, some other just kind of fans that were there for the games and everything. And you know, obviously a bunch of the PLL crew was there. So, It was great to go have some barbecue, which, again, Jordy crushed it. It was delicious. I ate entirely too much of it and had a blast there. Took in a little bit of Colorado and Oregon. Folks, I'm not a football podcast. I'm not a football expert, but yikes, that was ugly. So after the barbecue event, you know, I went to where I was staying for the night, which was to a friend's house that lives in the area. And I got there expecting to basically pass out, even though it was only like 8 o'clock. It had been a long day for me at that point. I had a whole lot of food in me. But they had ordered pizza and were having friends over. So I stayed up for a little while, had some pizza, had a good time, watched the end of Ohio State and Notre Dame, put Nick Casello in my thoughts and prayers, and then I went to bed. So, you know, really, those are the kind of days that I love. Trying to do this thing that I do of trying to fake it like I'm legit media or something, but trying to go to a city and really experience a city. I felt like I really did that on Saturday, and it blended really well with what the PLL rolled out there. So, you know, I thought Saturday was well executed by the PLL and by myself, if you don't mind my saying so. Sunday, got up, had breakfast, but I was pretty eager to get over to the stadium. I wanted to go and see the pregame stuff that they had, because they had the Friday Beers partnership going on. They had like the DJ set and everything. And, you know, obviously the Premier Zone is dialed up, like the whole the fan experience there is dialed up a little bit harder for championship weekend. But I also wanted to see, like, what kind of shape was the field going to be in? What kind of shape was the tailgating going to be in? Were people going to be scared off by the weather? Because it did not improve at all from Saturday to Sunday. And then, you know, obviously it had dumped rain all day Saturday. It was dumping rain Sunday. It dumped rain overnight. And the Philadelphia Union, who play in Subaru Park as their home venue, had played a game the night before. But field was in, honestly, great shape and held up incredibly well during the game, too. You know, I don't know, maybe this is not the norm anymore, but I'm from an era where if you played in the rain by, like, the middle of the first quarter, like, the area in front of the goalie and, like, the, you know, kind of the middle of the field on the defensive ends was just, like, it's mud. But that never really happened. The field stayed in pretty good shape. So I wanted to go see that, but really I just wanted to kind of get a feel for the vibes and everything, see how, you know, people were showing up. And, again, I touched on it at the top, but the Philly fans, the weather did not deter them. I thought the crowd was pretty good. So I guess onto the game itself, right? This is taking too long to get there, but onto the game itself. It starts out, and, you know, it was interesting at the beginning because y'all knew what the face-off story was going to be. Water Dogs were going to do what they do and not face off with anybody. It was going to be Courier probably and Gobrecht and, you know, their usual deal against Sisselberger, who I've been preaching was like the king of killing the prevent because he's been so good at it all year. And then to start the game, Sisselberger was not good at killing the prevent. You know, the Water Dogs, like, against all odds, were winning faceoffs. Like, well into the second quarter, the Water Dogs had a faceoff edge against Sisselberger. It wasn't like the Archers did anything different, but, you know, it was mostly Courier out there doing the damage. You know, I think he went above 50% on the game, but basically, to start the game, you know, it took a little while for the scoring to get going. It felt like the Water Dogs were putting on a little bit more pressure early, and they did get the first goal of the game. Ryan Conrad started the scoring, you know, just shy of midway through the first quarter. But, you know, the Water Dogs early on in that quarter, it felt like were really, really the ones kind of driving the momentum. O'Keefe gets a goal to answer it, and then Sowers gets on the board. You know, Sowers ripped a 2-point shot about 30 seconds into the game, and you could tell he was dialed for this. He was juiced. That it felt like, you know, I've never heard of a heat check shot that early in the game, but it felt like a heat check. Like, let's see what kind of day we're going to have. But after the Sowers goal, Archers took over for a while. Augevin hits a 2 that puts Archers up by a goal, and that also starts a 7-goal run. A 7-0 run that stretches like well into the second quarter before Ryan Conrad snaps it. And when it got to be, you know, whatever it was, 7-2, 8-2 even, I honestly, the thoughts were in my head, you know, because when I sat down to the game, I was like, all right, just not one of those semifinal blowouts again. I love the teams, but the blowouts, you can't have it. You know, like, even as just if you're trying to just be a fan, you don't want a blowout because blowouts mean people change the channel at home. You know, like, you don't want that stuff. So I didn't want to see the blowout happening. And I was like, oh, man, it's 8-2. Please don't have it go this way. But Water Dogs fight back. They get to within, I think, 3 goals at halftime. They end the second half they end the first half on a 3-goal run. And then Archers kind of get that first goal of the second half, which felt huge. Trey LeClaire scored the first goal of the second half. And in that moment, that was one of those goals where you're just like, man, whoever gets the next one in this game is just grabbing momentum. You know, the Archers, they're going to either snap that run that ended the half, you know, with Sowers scoring with 7 seconds left before halftime to get the Water Dogs back within whatever it was, 2 or 3. And then, you know, if they can keep that running at the start of the third quarter, then they're going to be right back in this thing. But Trey LeClaire kind of had a big one there. Kelly answers, and then Sisselberger gets on the board, and that was a massive, massive moment because the Archers needed him to be playing with more confidence. He had committed some bad turnovers. He had really kind of – the first half was not his best half of the season by any stretch. But he had a goal in the third quarter where he just won it forward – and took it all the way to the goal, Water Dogs were slow to go to him because it's, again, it's Sisselberg. You don't want to, I mean, if you're sliding off of any of Moore, Ament, or O'Keefe to go guard Mike Sisselberger, you're making a mistake. So Sisselberger takes his shot, scores, and it was, you could see how much it meant to the team, to the bench, to the Archers in general, because everybody in the offense was going nuts. Matt McMahon ran the length of the field from the defensive end all the way up to the other goal just to give Sisselberger a pat on the helmet and be like, way to go. Let's do this. Come on, let's go now. And you could see that that goal for Sisselberger really energized him. And I, you know, it felt like it's weird to say he finally settled in because we're in the third quarter. It's kind of like to think about somebody settling in. But I thought that goal for him was massive in that moment, because then you felt like, all right, the prevent is not going to be doing this thing anymore where the Water Dogs are winning faceoffs. Like, you know, Sisselberger is going to be fighting. But Water Dogs are able to answer that. They're able to deal with that kind of momentum shift with a goal by Walker. And then Jake Caraway hits a two-pointer. And all of a sudden, at the end of the third quarter, Water Dogs are just down one. You know, you're like thinking you're back to 8-2, and you're just like, how did this happen? But Water Dogs had just battled back, and it started to feel like a game that we'd had early in the season, you know, where it was like the Water Dogs were down big and they just fight and they just find a way to win. And it started to feel like one of those, man, they are going to find it. I don't know where it's going to come from, but they're going to find a way to win in this game. Zach Currier ties it up early in the fourth quarter. All of a sudden, it's anybody's game. And then Mac O'Keefe gets one. LeClaire gets one. Water Dogs get some power play opportunities as things kind of got sloppy. We'll get into one of these in a second, because there's three big plays in this game that I'm going to talk about a little more in depth in a second. But Conrad and Caraway get one, and then Schreiber is obviously, that's one of the big plays we're about to talk about here, scores with about 90 seconds left, and that's it. And that's the last goal of the game. That makes it 15-14. Jake Caraway gets off a really, really good-looking two-pointer that Brett Dobson gets just enough of in this game. Just enough of. And keeps it wide so that the Archers win. But the plays we want to talk about in this game. There's three really big ones, I think, the three that have gotten the most talk and have gotten the most kind of revisiting on social and all that kind of stuff. Not necessarily in the order they happened, but just three plays. Number one is the Graham Hossack hit on Ben Randall, because that sends Water Dogs to a power play where I believe they actually scored a goal on that power play. They might have even given up a shorty before they scored on it. But so the hit itself was, I'm sure you've seen it by now. If you haven't, Randall, the Water Dogs are clearing. Randall is kind of streaking up the field, and he's catching an over-the-shoulder pass, and Graham Hossack kind of lines him up from like a, you know, I think I'm being fair if I say a good 8 or 10 yards away. It's got to be at least that far that Hossack gets that much of a running start. And, it's a wide receiver going over the middle in football on a free safety clearing him out. It's that kind of hit. I don't think the hit itself was malicious or dirty or anything like that. I thought Hossack put his shoulder right through Ben Randall's chest, and it was a violent collision. It knocked Randall's helmet off. It obviously stopped the game for a second because Randall was pretty shaken up by it. He's able to return to the game. But, you know, I think there's a lot of people saying it shouldn't have been a flag because the hit itself was, as you look at it, pretty clean. Again, I thought Hossack, you know, I was up above, you know, in the press box area, so I wasn't exactly right on top of the play or anything, but from my vantage point, Hossack put his shoulder right through Randall's numbers and put him on the ground, violently so. That said, they flagged it, they called unnecessary roughness, and I'm going to tell you why. To the letter of the rule, it's the right, you're supposed to flag the hit. I know the hit was basically clean, but in the rule book, I'm going to read to you from the rule book now. Here's the definition of unnecessary roughness in the rule book. Shall be defined as an excessive infraction of any action by one player to another that is deliberate, dangerous, and or violent, including the following. The first definition is punching somebody or tackling or kicking somebody. Obviously, that's not what happened here. The second one, defenseless player. And that's what we're talking about here. Because again, Randall is looking back over his shoulder and has no idea that Graham Hossack is charging him from 10 yards away. Here's the league definition of a defenseless player. Any action deemed dangerous against a defensive player, any player who is not within 5 yards of a loose ball is considered defenseless. Any player is defenseless if he is looking away from the contact, such as a player who is in the act of attempting to scoop a ground ball or catch a pass, or a player who is in any other defenseless position. That, I mean, like, it's like they saw the play and then wrote the rule. That's how close the rule applies to what we saw. Right? Ben Randall is very clearly looking away from contact as a player who is attempting to catch a pass. That's what happened, and he got lit up. The rule says that's unnecessary roughness. Now, if you want to say the hit's clean, I don't like the flag, okay, I think what you're saying is not that the problem. I don't think Matty Palin probably had a problem with the hit, but to the letter of the law here, that's unnecessary roughness as defined in the PLO rulebook. If you want to say, I don't like the rule and they should change the rule, okay, I think that's a fair discussion to have. If you want to say he should be able to do that, the hit was clean, it should be all right, we should allow for that kind of thing, then all right. I think that's where the discussion can be had, is I don't like the rule as it's written. But you can't not like the penalty because they enforce the rulebook. It's the rule. You got to call that if that's what it is. You can't let it go. So, you know, I think I understand both sides of the things of, you know, you want to see those kind of plays. Again, the whole year we've been seeing the tough game, right? The video from the PLL with guys getting lit up and playing hard and all that. And, you know, this is one of those things that when they remake the tough game, that hit's going to be in it, regardless of the fact that it was a penalty. But, you know, I think, you know, you kind of want to say, let's change the rule. Okay. But you can't say they shouldn't flag it. It's right there in the rule book. He has to flag it. It's a perfect definition of unnecessary roughness as written in the rule book. He has to flag it. So that was one play. The second play I want to talk about, I thought was maybe the biggest play of the game. Well, not the biggest, you know, but a top two or three biggest play of the game. Connor Marr's run out, I thought, was probably the difference maker late. So a shot from Water Dogs goes wide or gets deflected, goes save, is bouncing towards the end line. Michael Sowers is there, you know, backing it up. And he's kind of starting to do that, like you take the little shuffle steps as you get close to the end line so that you're that guy right there with like your toes on it. And Connor Marr basically comes out of nowhere and dives sort of around Sowers to get like his head and shoulders in front of him. Right. The thing that makes this so insane is the timing of it. Because he makes that dive right at the second the ball actually goes out of bounds. If any part of Connor Marr is out of bounds when that happens, he's no longer the closest player. Because if you're out of bounds, you don't count. So when he dives, that is just like wholesaling it. Just a prayer of a play where if he gets it, that possession at that point in the game, this is late in the fourth quarter, that possession is massive because it's an opportunity to either retake the lead, take time off the clock. But if he times that differently, it doesn't happen. If he doesn't get the exact angle right, it doesn't happen. If he contacts Sowers at all from the back because he's running from behind him to make that play, it doesn't happen. There's a ridiculous amount of precision that went into this play that looked like somebody just throwing their body towards the end line. And the number of factors from the timing, from the angles, from where it happens, when it happens, you know, when the ball goes out of bounds, the stars completely have to be aligned for that to work. And Marr made, if you let him make 100 more tries at that, I bet you 99 times one of those things goes wrong. It was just like out of sheer chance. The fact that he got that possession back for them in that moment, and he's a rookie. He's a rookie in a championship game. I saw that play and I couldn't believe what my eyes were seeing. When he saw it, I was like, oh my God, he backed it up. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. I'm not a cheer in the press box guy at all. You're up there to kind of be a pro and be objective and just talk about what's happened or write about what's happened. In that moment, I let out a holy shit. I couldn't believe it. So I thought that was one of the biggest plays of the game. It's starting to get more, you're seeing it on social and everything. But again, as you see the highlights, just consider all the things that are in the lacrosse rulebook that would disallow that from that possession to go Connor Marr's way, and he avoids every single one of them. He's tap dancing over laser beams. It's insane. And then the last one. All right, let's talk about it. Tom Schreiber's last goal. So I'll give you the shakedown here of why this was and what kind of is everybody's big, I guess, problem with the goal. So the Archers take a shot. It hits something on its way to the net and is backed up, and the Archers keep possession. The referees say it hit. At that point, I believe Matt DeLuca was in the game because Dylan Ward had gotten hurt. The referees say it's a save. Reset the shot clock. So they give him a reset back to 32 seconds. The replay, it seems pretty clear that the ball hits Ben Randall, I believe it is, the defenseman in front of the net. It does not hit DeLuca. It does not hit the goal. So no reset should have been awarded. So right there, the Archers have a little bit of extra time. A lot of extra time. They get a full shot clock reset there. They get 32 seconds instead of whatever it was going to be. I can't remember how much time was left in the clock. You know, probably somewhere between 10, 15, 20 seconds. So they get the extra, basically a full extra offensive possession there. When they restart it, Tom Schreiber, on that ensuing possession, scores a goal to put the Archers up 15-14. He does it with 2 seconds left on the shot clock. So the Archers use that full 32 that they shouldn't have had, and Schreiber buries a goal with 2 seconds left on the clock. The shot clock took a good few seconds to start when the Archers restarted play from 32. So again, they got more even than 32 seconds worth of clock on that possession. So there were two things that happened here. They got a reset that they probably shouldn't have gotten, and then a late start to the shot clock gave them a couple extra seconds as well. And when you have Tom Schreiber, you give him couple extra seconds, he's going to score. He did it with 2 seconds left on the clock, and that's it. So, you know, to the discussion about it, you know, in the post game, Coach Copeland was asked about it, obviously, and what he was kind of looking for from the officials there and everything. And Coach Copeland, I think, answered the question as well as anybody could. He did gave the answer that you absolutely should give. He prefaced it by saying that, look, he loves Matty. He thinks the officials do a good job, you know, by and large. And he loves the league office and the kind of the presence that they have there on the sideline to try and get calls right. But on something like that, on a shot that definitely should not award a reset, you know, he was saying it would be nice to be able to go under the hood and get that right, to take a look at replay and get that right. Whether that's via coach's challenge or whatever, but I'm adding that part, whether that's via coach's challenge, whatever. But the go under the hood part was Coach Copeland talking about it. And I think, look, it's going to be something where it's fresh right now, and it's going to be particularly painful, particularly if you're a Water Dogs coach, player, fan, whatever, that stinks, that they got extra time and they used it to score what would ultimately be the game-winning goal. Somebody I really feel for in that situation, I'll tell you, is Zach Currier, and Dylan Ward, really, too. Anybody who was on the Outlaws in 2019, if you don't remember the 2019 MLL title, the Outlaws are playing the Bayhawks late in that game. The penalties in the game were remarkably one-sided. I think the Outlaws, you know, got called for like 10 or 12 penalties, and the Bayhawks, I think, maybe had one or two. Something it was like a wild disparity. And then very late in the game, the Outlaws, I think both, you know, Zach and I think Coach Seaman at the time was saying to the refs, and this is something coaches do all the time. If they're trying to get a timeout and they know it's going to be bang, bang, he'll say to the ref, hey, look, if I get the ball right here, I'm going to call timeout. Make sure you can see me. I'm going to call timeout. I'm going to be screaming timeout. And then the Outlaws pick the ball up. They are able to force kind of a a situation where they get the ball. And Seaman screaming for a timeout. I think Currier screaming for a timeout, and the refs just don't give it to him. And Bayhawks keep the ball. Bayhawks are able to kind of score late. I think Andrew Q hits the game winner with like a minute left after that. As a result of that timeout play, Zach Currier got ejected from that game. It was a disaster from a refereeing standpoint and from the Outlaw standpoint for sure. But you know, again, now if you're Zach Currier or you're any of those Outlaws guys, you've been involved in two of these championship games in the last 5 years that have had a significant impact from officiating in a game deciding moment and a play that where the game deciding goal kind of followed it. So, you know, it's obviously heartbreaking for those Water Dogs guys to go through that, particularly guys like Zach who have just done that, you know, with the Outlaws a few years ago. I'll say this kind of part of it. Nobody loves an asterisk conversation, by the way, more than sports social media. Immediately it was like, people should put an asterisk on this because it shouldn't have happened that way and blah, 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 blah. I am almost never on team put an asterisk on something. I think you save the, this has always been my stance. Save the asterisk for when somebody does something like malicious, wrong. They cheat. They knowingly are breaking the rules in the course of winning a title. Like a team showing up, you know, a college team showing up with players they know are ineligible and putting them on the field. Or, you know, you got guys out there who have people taking their tests for them. Or, you know, if the program knows they are breaking the rules, or the team knows they are breaking the rules, or they're cheating in some way, or they're throwing games, whatever it is, you asterisk that, right? Somebody has altered the outcome on purpose in a way that's malicious. Mistakes and being a human being happens, and it sucks when it happens like that. It's brutal. I mean, I realize if you're a Water Dogs fan listening to this, you probably want to reach through the audio and punch me in the face because it's no consolation for me to say that. But like, you don't need an asterisk here because it's just how this game got played. If you want an asterisk on this, you need to go put one on Duke and Penn State. You want to go do that? Should that game have an asterisk, or is that just the story of that game is now that it probably changed a rule, or that we all kind of remember that moment? There's no actual asterisk for it, but we all remember that moment. Do you want to put an asterisk on UVA hitting a crossbar that counted as a goal? Does that game need an asterisk? You want to really run wild with it? You got to maybe have to put one on the 2018 gold medal for Team USA. You need one because maybe an offsides call maybe got missed. Maybe there was some timing there, some clock operation there that didn't go perfectly well. I'm just saying, if you want to do asterisks, you got to do it for things like this, for things like Schreiber and the clock thing. Then you got to reckon with all these other times where this has happened. And it sucks that it happens. It happens in pro sports with timing stuff sometimes. But I don't know what else you can really do about it other than, to Coach Copeland's point, have that be a play, that shot clock reset, be something that you can take a look at and make sure that we got the clock right. Make sure that the right call has been made there, because at that point in the game, you're talking less than 2 minutes left or 2 minutes left or so. That's one or two possessions left for both teams. That is massive. A massive amount of time at that point. So, you know, I feel for you Water Dogs fans and Water Dogs players and coach and everybody out there wearing the purple and everything. I really do feel for you, but you know, it just kind of happens. And I will say this, my honest assessment of the game anyway, is that I think the better team won yesterday. I thought the Archers were better. I thought they were the better team. You know, regardless of how that last couple minutes played out, I thought they were the better team. And speaking of how the last couple minutes played out, a lot of the people clamoring or people who are upset about the timing, if they are Water Dogs fans, will leave out the fact that they got a 2-point shot to win it at the buzzer off the stick of Jake Caraway. Again, like one of their top two, I would say, 2-point shooters are like Jake and like Connor Kelly, you know? So they got probably one of the guys they would want to take that shot, taking an open 2-pointer at the end of the game to win it that Brett Dobson saves, that the game MVP Brett Dobson saves. They had a chance to win it late, even after that timing snafu, after the timing mess. They still had a chance to win the game. They still could have won. So, you know, I feel for you Water Dogs fans. I hope maybe there's something they will take a look at. They look at other things that they can be challenged or can be reviewed or whatever. I always am I tilt toward the side of less review is better. I hate, you know, for a league that's looking for as many ways as it can to speed up gameplay, slowing it down with a lot of instant replay reviews is probably not what you want to see right now. But, you know, I guess I wouldn't hate it. And I know now I've mentioned him twice, but Brett Dobson in this game was incredible. Game MVP. It was funny. I was sitting in the press box next to another media guy, and we were talking about who game MVP would have been. I don't know how they pick game MVP because the media doesn't pick it. It's weird. Like when I go do like the Final Four or do other like the Ivy Championship or whatever, the media, there's a ballot that gets passed around. Pull a curtain back for you. It just gets passed around the press box where you vote right in your all tournament team and your MVP. Media don't have a say in this. So I guess the league just decides who it is, but Brett Dobson won it. And another media person, when the game was going on, was like, who do you think is going to get it? I said, if the Water Dogs pull it off, if they had pulled off the comeback and won the game, I would have given it to Zach Currier because he was everywhere. He was ridiculous. And if the Archers won it, I really wasn't totally sure. I thought it could have gone to a couple of different guys. I really did. You know, you look at kind of what guys were doing in this game, and it like blew my mind. Like you look up and all of a sudden Chalen Rogers is out there with a pole. I'm just like, what is going on here? But if the Archers had won it, I think at that point in the game, I was probably thinking Schreiber. And the reason I was thinking that way was like, because we were like, Brett Dobson's playing out of his mind. It's what got us there. And I was like, yeah, but goalies don't win MVP of these things. They give it to the, you know, they sort by points or whatever. With my case being that last year, Michael Sowers got it and Wardo should have. I thought Dylan Ward was by far the game MVP last year, but he didn't get it. I figured, oh, they give it to the point guy or they give it to the local guy. So, you know, maybe they'll give it to Grant Amon or something. But so, you know, I thought Dobson, though, very much deserved it. 18 saves. And through the first half, I think he was over 70%. And that run, that 7-goal run, and there were a couple goals that kind of went this way. You know, a lot of the ones that kind of ended with like Mac O'Keefe on the end of him getting dunks. Dobson did it better than anybody in the sport this year. Anybody. Off a save, he gets that ball out, and that Archers rope unit, man, they go defense to offense, and it's deadly. Everybody else is going defense to offense with guys who are your short stick D-middies, who, you know, are maybe not as skilled as your offensive guys. The Archers go defense to offense with Trey LeClaire and Ryan Augavin and Chalen Rogers, like offensive powerhouse players. So I thought you saw Dobson start a lot of transition. If you wanted to go look at goals created for him in that game, I don't know if I could see the advanced numbers for just the game, but I'm going to guess he created, you know, 2 or 3 goals on his own off saves, which was huge. And some of them were in that big early run that really got the Archers moving in a positive direction. So, well-earned for Dobson. I think, you know, when you talk about Dobson too, the thing you want to highlight with him and with a bunch of other guys on this team, the way the salary cap has started working for a number of players who are on the team now is the first 4 picks in the college draft have their contract value slotted. So the first guy gets X, second guy gets a little less, third guy gets a little less, fourth guy gets a little less. Fifth guy and onward get a league minimum $25,000, and it's a 3-year deal. So they get $25,000 a year for 3 years. So everybody who is taken from fifth onwards is on a ridiculously team-friendly deal for the first 3 years of their career. Piper Bond is on a league minimum deal until through 2025. Dobson's runs through next year. Justin Anasios runs through next year. Connor Morris runs through 2025. Matt Morris runs through next year. He's actually getting more. He's not on league minimum because he was taken in the first four picks. John Robbins runs through next year. Sisselberger runs through 2025. Cam Wires runs through 2025. All those guys, except Matt Moore, are making the league minimum for multiple years. This rookie class, Bond, Marr, like, and Sisselberger, are making the league minimum, and they're doing it for the next 2 years. You think about what that makes available to you in free agency when you can make, now you can keep, you know, Mac O'Keefe signed a 2-year deal here. You can keep him, but like Matt McMahon, Warren Jeffrey, Ryan Ambler, all about to be free agents. You got money for them because you don't got to pay the kids. They're cheap. So I think that kind of foundational stuff going on there is, from a finance and a league cap point of view, really positions the Archers well. Because they're not just getting stars by drafting at the top of the draft. They're getting cheap players. Very cheap players. You know, you look at the Water Dogs, and it's basically the same deal for them, but like Jack Hanna, Jake Higgins, Alex Mazzone, McConvey is making league minimum. Obviously, then, you know, you have the face-off guy, you have James Riley in there, but like the Archers in particular, they nailed those picks so well this year. And it's not just that they got them all right. They got them all right at league minimum spots in the draft. Sisselberger went fifth right after that, right where that first pick at league minimum comes. And then Connor Marr, Piper Bond, man, you're feeling good about that. And it was so good that they had to nail it too, because, you know, I mentioned there a second ago, Jalen Rogers out there with a long pole. This is a team that lost the Trell Harris short stick D midi of the year to injury, torn ACL. This team lost John Robbins back in week six? Like right after the All-Star break? He went on the PUP list and didn't dress again? And he was like a top pull for them. So Cam Wires comes in and is doing his thing at the LSM spot. And then Cam Wires goes down with a lower body injury in the title game. Jalen Rogers is out there with a pull, and they still are able to put it together because of just how versatile they are with that rope unit in the midfield of guys who can go D to O. So, you know, the way that roster got constructed last offseason, I know the focus was on they have Mac O'Keefe now. You know, that was their big signing, really, was the reuniting of Mac O'Keefe with Brett Dobson. But the rope unit, to have Augerman back, make sure you have LeClaire, and then you add a Jalen Rogers, you make sure you still have Latrell, and it became clear, and then even through the draft, when they went with Marr, I believe ahead of Piper Bond. I might have that wrong. But they went with Marr ahead of other short stick D-middies who were probably better defenders than Marr, but not as good in transition. It became clear what they were trying to build, and obviously they did it very successfully. So I will get more into the rosters. I'll do a what's next. I've written one about each team that, as they've been eliminated from the playoffs this year. So there's a what's next for what the offseason should hold or could hold for each team in the league. The one coming for the Archers and Water Dogs are coming soon. What's next for the Archers now is going to the championship series in February and being the only team there that was there last year, which is kind of cool for them. You know, what's next for the Water Dogs is last free agency period, they signed everybody for 2 years. This whole team is basically back. They've got to bring back the big keys will be Burns and Gobrecht down low. And then, of course, Dylan Ward, who signed a 1-year deal last year. But look, if you got those three guys back, you're in a pretty good spot. We'll see. You know, I don't know how much of a difference Charlie Kitchen would have made for them this year or if they really needed him, but he missed the season basically with injury. So, you know, but it's a team that's positioned, that's built to just keep doing this, the Water Dogs. They're very, very well constructed. So it's probably no coincidence why they were back where they were again. But yeah, after the game was over, we did media day. Again, you'll have, or media availability, I should say. You'll have quotables from that. Obviously, the Water Dogs were pretty crushed. That was a heartbreaker for them. You know, the Archers were elated, and they shouted out a lot of guys who have helped them along the way. I think you'll see a lot of that coming out. Again, you'll have quotables from this stuff coming soon. But, yeah, it's been a spectacular summer. and the PLL is now wrapped up in terms of field lacrosse and everything until next year when teams will have home markets. So the next things kind of coming here are college lacrosse, folks, fall ball. I'm going to the Headstrong Classic at Hofstra, hopefully in a couple weeks here. I will go down to the Fall Classic in Baltimore. I want to see Team USA and Team Canada and Penn State down there this year. The Knits are down there, so we'll do that. You got the NLL. Schedule release is coming. It's probably coming, if you're listening to this, on Tuesday. I think it's coming today. So you'll have that, and then the college season will be here before you know it. Championship Series in February. The show just never ends at this point. So it has been a fun PLL summer. I had a blast covering it. I went to logged a few too many miles and had a few too much to eat, but I think it was a really, really good time. I hope you've enjoyed my PLL coverage. I hope you stick around with me because the podcast is going to roll on forward, starting with fall ball and getting into college stuff. And I've got some content about college players I'm excited to watch this year. They're especially transfer portal kind of guys, so keep an eye out for that on Sticks In. And thank you again for sticking around with me. And we will see you.
Is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at. Like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.